From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Joshua Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Our moderator is Washington correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The long-awaited redacted report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller is finally out, and there is much to unpack. President Trump has vetoed a congressional resolution to end U.S. support for a military campaign led by Saudi Arabia in Yemen. North Korea has test-fired a tactical weapon, a new challenge to the U.S., and Pyongyang is also tired, apparently, of dealing with the U.S. Secretary of State. And finally, a fire ravages Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. Well, let's start, obviously, with the big news of the week. This long-awaited report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller is finally out, 448 pages. And while it says President Trump did not, to emphasize, did not collude with the Russians during the 2016 campaign, it does lay out at least 10 instances of possible obstruction of justice. Now, that suggests, Tom, that no matter what the president says, he remains in some kind of jeopardy here.
Well, certainly some sort of jeopardy with Congress, which has the ultimate authority to do something about this now. It's a question of what is the standard here? Is the standard that you can't go to jail because you can't be proven guilty of a crime, or is there some other standard? And I think that's what Robert Mueller is saying. It's true the report says that there was no collusion on the part of the president or his campaign with members of the Russian government. But another point, Mr. Mueller said, if I could have exonerated the president, I would have. That is a fairly damning sentence. I mean, I think the bottom line is, of the tens of thousands of words already written about this, was a line in the Washington Post that called the report a thick catalog of misconduct and mendacity that, if not criminal, is deeply unflattering. And I think that's true. You have an instance of the president asking his lawyer to fire Robert Mueller. And his lawyer, Donald McGahn, not only refused to do that, but threatened to resign if President Trump persisted. There are all sorts of instances like that. The firing of FBI Director James Comey is laid out. I think one of the other more interesting segments of the whole report was when the president is told that Mueller has been appointed the special prosecutor, and he blurts out, "This is the end of my presidency," and then issues an expletive about
that
we should not use, yes. And so it's a mixed bag. Yes, he couldn't prove criminal conduct, but he certainly did not give the president a pass. And so how that is all sorted out is now going to continue to play out. The president has declared a total victory, but that self-exoneration in every respect is not borne out.
Now, filling in for Josh Glancy, by the way, we welcome Jim Malone. Jim, welcome. Jim is a national correspondent for The Voice of America. Now, Jim, just to follow up on some of the things that Tom said, from President Trump's standpoint, he says he's vindicated here simply because the special counsel, i.e. Mr. Mueller, could not actually prove that he obstructed justice. But some of these things that Tom alluded to about trying to have Mueller fired, the only reason he was not fired is because the president's own lawyer refused to do that. It sounds like he attempted to interfere in an investigation, doesn't it?
Certainly sounds like he wanted to, not just in that case, but in several others. Look, let's lay out the bigger context for this whole thing. It's a little odd, isn't it? We already had last month the Attorney General lay out his summary of what Barr's report was. The important thing about this week was we actually got to see the Mueller report and all the detail. So there's this juxtaposition of Barr summarizing that the president is off the hook on collusion, basically off the hook on obstruction, because Mueller could not gather enough evidence to warrant prosecution going forward. But where does that leave things now? The detail, the incredible laid out detail in the Mueller report of all these incidents where the president appears to be wanting to influence or interfere with the investigation, I think that's going to give opposition Democrats in Congress now kind of a cudgel moving forward. They have something to seize on. Is it enough to try to move towards some sort of impeachment movement for the president? That's not clear, because Democrats don't seem to be united on impeachment. And as we know from the history, you need more than one party to move for impeachment in the end, because you need a bipartisan effort that could result in a vote in the Senate. So I think where we are now, it's kind of a messy state. The president is claiming he's been cleared. His people, his base supporters, are generally going to accept that. They were never that moved by this Mueller report anyway. So I think one of the questions moving forward is, what is going to be the overall impact of the Mueller report on the 2020 election, on Trump's presidency moving forward? The signature move here is we're moving from the legal arena now into the political arena, but I think it basically was always in the political arena anyway.
Now, this whole issue of impeachment, since we have listeners all around the world here, perhaps we should take a step back and explain what this impeachment process is. And it's essentially a two-step process. It would start in the House of Representatives, which right now is controlled by the opposition Democratic Party. They, in theory, can impeach a president for whatever they want. And the constitutional standard is high crimes and misdemeanors, which is a vague enough definition that they can make it literally anything they want. They only need a margin of one vote to do that, and they have a lot more than that. So mathematically, they could impeach the president for anything. And the report that came out this week seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, more than enough to move forward. But again, it's a two-step process. The second part of that would be if he were impeached in the House. Our listeners should also understand that the process would then move to the upper chamber of our Congress, that's called the Senate. And there, it's a much harder task. It takes a two-thirds vote, 67 votes. And mathematically, the Republicans control that chamber. So mathematically, it's almost impossible for that to happen. Although, intriguingly, if you look at the people in the Senate on the Republican side now, those who voted to convict Bill Clinton about 20 years ago over his alleged indiscretions, there are 14 Republicans who did that. So if you tacked on 14 Republicans to the Democrats in the Senate, that's not too far from a two-thirds majority.
That's right. But the other complication for those who would like to remove President Trump from office is that there's going to be a presidential election and congressional election in November of 2020, less than 2 years away. And it's fair to say that Republican members of Congress, especially in the Senate, are terrified of crossing President Trump because his base is so strong and so powerful and basically dominates the Republican Party that Republican senators, especially up for re-election in 2020, are afraid that if they cross President Trump, he will unleash his base on them in a primary election and they may lose. So I think you're right. The numbers are intriguing, Paul, but I don't think the Republicans are going to show any profiles in courage at the moment to think about convicting President Trump. I mean, President Clinton was impeached by the House, but he was acquitted in a Senate trial and he remained in office. So
essentially on a party line vote.
Exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Mueller report is going to just further this political polarization we have. Where you stand on the Mueller report is pretty much going to depend on where you sit. And that is, Republicans here see the top line coming out as there's no legal action warranted moving further against the president. That's going to be enough for most of them. I'm sure they're not comfortable with a lot of the incidents detailed in the report, especially regarding possible instances of obstruction. The Democrats are going to seize on that, but they're already motivated against the president anyway. It's going to further that sort of agitation on their part. And we're already hearing some Democratic members of Congress, especially in the House, saying, look, we have a responsibility to do oversight. We have a responsibility to move forward investigating these things, whether that will lead to impeachment or not. And there are going to be, though, some on the left who are going to agitate now I think, for the Democratic House to move toward impeachment. So that's going to be an internal debate within the Democratic Party. But I think more broadly in the country, the argument over Mueller is going to be this. It's basically going to morph into the argument over Trump. Where do you stand on President Trump?
I mean, the leader of the House Democrats is the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, the very powerful Speaker. And she's said in the past that this issue of impeachment was not something that she considered a priority. She said, we want the president removed from office, but the best way to do that is at the ballot box in November 2020. And although the number two House Democrat, Steny Hoyer of Maryland, said, well, we still don't think this issue of impeachment is the way to go. We think voting him out is the preferable option. We've not yet heard from Ms. Pelosi herself about that. Is it possible that her point of view might change in light of what we learned?
It's possible, Paul, quite possible, but we don't know. This report was released on the eve of a long Easter holiday weekend in Washington. Members are gone for another several days, so it'll take a while for this to sort out. But it all depends on, if you love Trump, the damning parts of this Mueller report will not trouble you. If you don't love Trump, there will be things that are very disconcerting to you and probably quite embarrassing to the president. And it'll all get sorted out by November 2nd of next year, which is the presidential election. At that point, we'll know whether voters think this is a big deal or not a big deal.
Well, we're going to be talking about this, I'm sure, right up until that election, no question about it. Well, let's pause for a short break here. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Did you know you can download the program? It's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Joshua Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Our moderator is Washington correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Welcome back. President Trump has vetoed a congressional resolution to end U.S. support for a military campaign led by Saudi Arabia in Yemen. That campaign has resulted in the deaths of thousands of civilians, men, women, and children. It has also exacerbated, analysts say, a terrible famine there. It's making things all the worse. Tom, why did the president veto this resolution?
Well, basically to show solidarity with the government of Saudi Arabia, most importantly, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Sultan, the strong man of Saudi Arabia. The president considers Saudi Arabia to be a linchpin of his Middle East policy. Specifically, he sees Saudi Arabia as a buffer against Iran and Iranian attempts to expand Iranian influence in the country. And I think to show solidarity with MBS, as he is called, the president vetoed this. He put out a statement saying, this usurps my constitutional authority as the commander-in-chief to wage war. But I think it really came down to supporting an ally, Saudi Arabia, that the president feels is important to him and to his foreign policy. The fact that Congress passed this with Republican votes, especially in the Senate, was a rebuff. And I think a year ago this would not have happened. But the fact that it did happen, even though I think it's a reflection of growing unhappiness within the U.S. Congress, especially the Senate, about what the U.S. is doing to help the Saudis wage this war in Yemen.
We were just talking prior to the break about the solidarity that Republicans have to President Trump, at least domestically, and yet now we're talking about a major foreign policy issue where there appear to be, as you say, some cracks in the wall in terms of Republican support for him. Beyond Saudi Arabia, of course, what other cracks might exist? There are issues with the Russians and his dealings with China and that kind of thing.
And North Korea as well. And I also think NATO. I think especially many Republicans in the U.S. Senate don't support the president on his view of NATO is not a big deal anymore. And I suspect that the president has been successful in persuading many NATO members to increase their defense spending, but nowhere near as much as the president would like. But I think European leaders are very concerned about President Trump. They don't consider him a a reliable ally on matters of East-West, of Russia versus the West. And so a lot of members of Congress, particularly in the Senate, are worried about that. So I think you're going to see additional pressure on the president's foreign policy. It's a way for Republicans who are troubled by some of the things the president has been doing overseas to show some distance and to show some independence while not breaking totally with him.
This issue of a NATO spending, the president says that NATO spending has been going up, which is true. He says it's all because of him. However, if you look at NATO figures provided by the alliance itself, it indicates that overall spending has been actually increasing since 2014, well before the president came to office. And the reason for that, again, NATO officials say, is because of the Russian annexation of Crimea, which again occurred long before the president came to office. So the spending has been increasing. He's taking credit for it, but he is correct in saying that there are still a fair number of countries within the alliance, notably Germany, certainly the biggest economy in Europe, which is not spending anywhere near the 2% that the alliance recommends. So on some level, he does have a point.
He does have a point. The truth of the matter is President Trump and German Chancellor Angela Merkel don't get along. They're not friendly. They're not friends. They have fundamental political and strategic differences. And so the Germans have little use for President Trump, and President Trump has little use for the Germans. And that probably won't change until Mrs. Merkel is out of power or President Trump is out of power. This is a delicate minuet here, but the president is not popular in Europe, and I don't suspect that the Germans will give President Trump much satisfaction on spending ever.
The other issue about NATO that I find interesting, and I'm not quite sure that it's gotten a lot of attention in the United States, is the fact that we know that the president is a kind of a transactional man. He likes individual deals with individual entities and so forth. And yet NATO countries seem to be processing their own individual deals with other parties as well. For example, the Germans with this gas pipeline to Russia. And Turkish government is also buying an anti-aircraft weapon system from the Russians. As if these are members of a NATO dealing with the Russians on their own, that's not exactly conducive to this firm alliance in the first place, is it?
No, it's not at all. The bottom line is President Trump does not like multilateral arrangements. And so by definition, he doesn't have a lot of faith or confidence in NATO. And he would prefer to do one-on-one deals with the Russians, with the North Koreans, with the Chinese.
President, he seems upset that others are doing the very same thing, though.
Right. That's right. And they're doing it, I think, because they're worried about President Trump's tendencies of going it alone. And I think the Europeans are saying, well, if he's going to go it alone, we're going to have to go alone and do the same sort of thing. It's not a good situation.
The other foreign policy issue that I wanted to get to this week is North Korea. Now, the president has met with Kim Jong-un, the leader of that country, twice. He's talking about a possible third meeting with Kim. Kim has indicated that he's now somewhat ambivalent about dealing with the United States. He said this week that he doesn't want to deal with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, anymore. He calls Mr. Pompeo immature. He doesn't want to deal with him. What on earth do you think President Trump might do about that?
There's not a lot he can do. If Chairman Kim doesn't want to have a third meeting, there's not going to be a third meeting. It sounds to me like the honeymoon is over a little bit. The president keeps saying, I have a very friendly relationship with Chairman Kim. We're friends. But you get a feeling that the Chinese have dialed back, and I think maybe the president has dialed back as well. I mean, it's becoming clear that the North Koreans have no interest whatsoever in giving up their nuclear weapons program. That's not going to happen. And the president and his Secretary of State have always said our goal has to be total denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And so that's not going to happen. And so maybe both sides are saying, well, we both got what we wanted from this. We got two high-profile telegenic meetings, and now we're going to have to go back to the hard work of diplomacy. I think the honeymoon is over. Where it goes from here is anybody's guess.
It's uncertain beyond these glittery photo ops from these two meetings. things, what of substance has come out of either one of them?
The Chinese, for several months, didn't test any weapons, and they still haven't tested any long-range ballistic missiles, nuclear weapons, missiles that are capable of reaching the west coast of the United States. This new test is a short-range battlefield missile. So in that sense, I think there's been some progress. But on the other hand, you get a feeling that there may be a hiatus here without escalation, but I don't think there's no evidence that significant improvement is being made on the president's goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula.
The president told us after the first summit meeting with Kim, which was in June of 2018, I believe, he said, well, the North Koreans have begun to denuclearize, which certainly does not appear to be the case.
No, intelligence satellite photos suggest that they are expanding their nuclear weapons program, not reducing it at all. And that's probably a bitter pill for the president. I mean, Kim is a wily operator. He's nothing about him that is particularly attractive. And I think Kim has figured out that the one thing that gives him leverage is his nuclear program, and there's no way on earth that he's going to give that up. And that just makes it hard to see how much further tensions can be reduced.
Well, in our final moments, I wanted to get to a story that I think has touched pretty much everybody in the past week or so, and that has been this terrible fire that swept through Notre Dame, of course, this magnificent cathedral in the heart of Paris. This tremendous damage was done, but thank goodness the fire was stopped before it got even worse. It seems like everybody was touched by this story.
It's an extraordinary outpouring of grief and affection for a 12th century cathedral. It's probably Notre Dame is probably more iconic than even the Eiffel Tower. And it is just a kind of a symbol of France around the world. I suspect that anyone who goes to Paris goes to see Notre Dame. It is that much of an icon and a symbol of faith and renewal and resilience. And now the bell towers are standing, the sides of the church are standing, but the roof was destroyed, and the damage to artifacts, historic artifacts, seems to be minimal, but it's going to take years, probably 5 years, maybe longer, to restore it. But it is one of those things that you just don't expect to happen. And it is the outpouring of sympathy and concern around the world in an age of polarization and all the other things we talk about every week is somehow encouraging.
I think so, and that's sort of the thing I think that I find so interesting is that our ability to be touched by something like this and to be empathetic about that. I think there's some sort of level of humanity in the fact that we can all be touched by that. Even if you have never been to France or to Paris, I think, as you say, most people know what Notre Dame is, one of the most grand symbols of, certainly in France and in the world, frankly. So
could possibly be the most most iconic Gothic cathedral in the world. I guess it's nice with all the storm and rage around politics in Europe and especially around the United States these days. It's nice to see people's energies, their psychic energies, channeled into something like this. Hundreds of millions of dollars have already been contributed or pledged to rebuild the Church of Notre Dame, goodwill is—it just shows that goodwill is not totally out of vogue in this globe.
Good. We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. Also, Jim Malone, who was with us earlier in the program. He, of course, national correspondent for The Voice of America. This program was produced by Carol Castiel, our engineer, Nick Ivanov. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thank you for listening.